exporters face the music today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Falling oil prices make people in Saudi Arabia really nervous.
90% of government revenues come from oil. Oil is by far the main driver in the Saudi economy.
And in Venezuela, the cash-strapped government goes for a big hike in the price of gas.
But Venezuela still has the cheapest gas in the world. Now people are going to have to pay maybe as much as a quarter to fill their tank before they were paying less than a penny.
Plus, a daughter remembers growing up in a crowded New York City apartment.
When my parents needed privacy, they would lapse into this dialect. And I knew that it was a special language they had.
Those stories today on The World. Sun's out, guns out, you know, sleeveless shirts and all. That might be the new style someday soon in the Arctic, because last month it was warmer than usual up there, a lot warmer. NASA says January 2016 recorded the greatest departure from average of any month on record. That's globally. But the spike in temperatures last month was especially pronounced in the Arctic. I asked Gavin Schmidt to put this into context for us. He directs NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies.
So temperatures are going up pretty much everywhere around the world, except perhaps in Antarctica. And so when we have an El Nino event like we're currently having, that's really just an assist, and that kind of pushes you into record-breaking territory. But we would have had a record warm year even without the El Nino, and temperatures are not suddenly going to go back to the 1970s when this El Nino event is finished, perhaps by the middle of this year.
How is the warming Arctic impacting us here?
So we're seeing warming in the Arctic that's melting the floating ice. It's also melting the ice on Greenland. That's changing sea level patterns. So sea level is rising because of this melting ice. We have changes in circulation patterns. The wind patterns seem to be affected by the reductions in sea ice in the Arctic. And that is changing the patterns of storm tracks and perhaps the variability of wintertime temperatures right here where we live.
So here we are kicking off our show today with this news because it's important. I mean, the temperatures, as you say, this trend just keeps going up and up and up. What's it going to take for people to really give two cents about this? Because I know in a month or two, I'm going to be doing the same interview all over again.
So people have got to think about the long-term trends. You know, we like talking about the weather, and obviously that gives us a lot to talk about. But the long-term changes that we're seeing, these are very difficult to deal with. And we really need a sustainable conversation about how to deal with emissions, how to deal with transitions to renewable energy, transitions away from carbon emissions. And that's, that isn't an interview for one day or for one month or just because we had a record year. That's a discussion and a debate that has to go on for many years, even many decades to come.
The Paris climate talks in December, that wasn't the start of a conversation, a dialogue about all this?
Yeah, the Paris talks are, in fact, the start of that serious conversation. But just having had the Paris Agreement, that doesn't make all of those pledges come to fruition. How those pledges are actually going to be implemented and how they're going to be maintained and perhaps even enhanced, that still has to be decided.
Gavin Schmidt, director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Greatly appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
One thing that's not been helping with the rise in temperatures is the staggering drop in oil prices. Get this, in the past year and a half, the price of oil dropped from $100 a barrel to $30. Good if you want to drive a Hummer to the grocery store, not so great for the environment. But the polar bears aren't the only ones taking a hit from this. There are economies that rely entirely on oil revenue. And as you can imagine, they're not doing great these days. We're going to check in on two of them, Venezuela, in a moment. First, Saudi Arabia. It's one of the world's biggest exporters of oil, and they're in a pickle. Ben Hubbard is here to tell us more. He's a reporter with the New York Times based in Beirut. And you're just back from Riyadh, where you're reporting on this, Ben. How much of the Saudi economy does rely on oil?
Well, it's about 90% of government revenues come from oil. So it's just a massive, massive chunk of everything that the government does. I mean, oil is by far the main driver in the Saudi economy. And even historically, it's very difficult to overstate how important oil has been in the development of this kingdom. I mean, ever since it was discovered decades ago, it has literally fueled everything, whether it's, you know, the ability of the royal family to hold on to power, by, you know, offering very, very generous services and perks to its people. It's also played a large role in their foreign policy. It's played a large role in their religious policy of exporting their version of Islam to various places around the world. You have 70% of working Saudis who are employed by the government, and even the private sector, which has grown in Saudi in recent years, is still incredibly dependent on government spending. Mm. So when you have a hit to the budget, it really trickles down through the entire economy of this country.
Any good investor will tell you to diversify your portfolio. Did the Saudi government ever envision something like this? Did they have a plan B?
Well, there has been talk about diversifying away from oil for decades. I think the Saudis have realized that this was a vulnerability. And, you know, you can go back to some of the national plans going back a number, you know, many, many years when they've said, oh, we need to diversify away from oil. But they've never done that. Part of that has just been because of the oil boom or the very high prices in oil over the last 10 years. It just made that a very difficult transition to make. There was basically no pressure on them to try to diversify their economy because it was just too easy to fuel everything with oil. So that led to all the other problems that we just discussed in terms of high government employment, in terms of lavish benefits. And that these are the kind of things that they're going to have to reassess now that the oil price has dropped so low.
So you went to this career fair in Riyadh. That seems like a really good place to find out how this drop in oil prices is impacting the lives of everyday Saudis. What did you see?
Yeah, it's a very interesting feeling there because I think it's still important to emphasize that if you go to Saudi Arabia, you don't feel that this is a country in crisis. I mean, the country still has a lot going for it. There's still a tremendous amount of wealth that's been built up over the last, especially over the last decade. The government still has enormous reserves that are so large, they would sort of be the envy of any other country in the world. But when you speak to young people, you just get a sense that everybody kind of realizes that, in a way, the clock is ticking, things are changing, and that this system can't continue that much longer. And the two main factors in that change are, number one, the oil price, which we just discussed, and the fact that it's so low, that's taken a huge chunk out of budget. But the Saudis have survived oil crunches before at various points in their history. The main factor that's different this time is the demographics. The population of the kingdom is much, much larger than it's ever been, and it's a very, very youthful demographic. So we're talking about a country of 21 million citizens. There's about 10 million foreigners who also live there. But of those citizens, about 70% of them are under the age of 30. So, you know, economists and people who pay attention to Saudi Arabia say that there's somewhere in the order of 250,000 young Saudis who are entering the job market every year. In previous generations, you know, if you had a degree or if you had some qualifications, you would get out of college and you would pretty much immediately snap up a government job. There's no way that the government can employ all of these people. So they've really got to find their own way in the economy. So that's why the job fair was very interesting. This is one of the early places where you're kind of seeing this realization among the younger generation that it's not going to be the same for us that it was for our parents.
Did you get a sense of frustration among that youth bulge about this kind of new reality? And politically, could this fuel instability in the kingdom?
I don't know so much about frustration. I don't think it's been long enough. I mean, I don't think that your average Saudi family is feeling a cash crunch. The government has proposed a number of things that it's going to do.
Like what?
To try to retool the economy. I mean, there's a whole bunch of different things there. Everything from privatizing large government companies, privatizing the airports, privatizing ports, things like that. So that will provide a bunch of jobs in the private sector. It's a bit tricky to know, you know, implementation timelines and details haven't all been released yet. And so it's a bit hard to know when a lot of these plans are going to come into effect. And it's fair to expect as well that there's going to be a decent amount of pushback from inside the society. I mean, for 10 years, you know, a lot of people have grown very wealthy off the current system. And then all of a sudden the government says, okay, well, fuel prices are going to go up and electricity prices are going to go up. You know, it changes the entire business environment of the kingdom.
Ben Hubbard with The New York Times, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Now we turn our attention to another oil-producing giant, Venezuela. Its president, Nicolas Maduro, has just done something that seems totally counterintuitive at a time of falling oil prices. He raised the price of gasoline in Venezuela. It's part of his government's plan to try and rescue the country's crashing economy. Hannah Dreyer reports from Caracas for the Associated Press. So first of all, Hannah, I know Venezuela had some of the lowest prices per gallon on the planet, but even so, the price hike now represents a 6,000% increase? Really?
Yeah, for years, Venezuela has had the cheapest gas in the world. This is a huge increase percentage-wise, but Venezuela still has the cheapest gas in the world. Now people are going to have to pay maybe as much as a quarter to fill their tank. Before they were paying less than a penny.
A quarter, like 25 cents American to fill the entire tank?
Yeah, not even. A couple nickels, really.
Oh, my gosh. So, I mean, I'm going to say if anybody's reacting angrily, they're kind of barking up the wrong tree. How are people reacting, though?
You know, Venezuela is probably the only country in the world where people complain that they want higher gas prices. People know that something's very wrong in the economy. There are these huge shortages. People can't get the medicines they need. And at the pumps, people are saying they wish that they would raise the price of gas higher. This increase, people say, is going to do something to alleviate the deficit here. The deficit is running at 25% of GDP. And economists say this increase might account for maybe 1% of GDP. So it's a total drop in the bucket. But a huge hike in gas prices might go some way to solving things.
Yeah, politically, what would a huge hike in gas prices mean? Like if Venezuela started paying what we're paying here in the United States, would that straighten things out?
It's hard to know if anything could really straighten things out, but it might solve some of the crushing shortages, some of the real struggles of daily life here.
So I gather President Maduro also changed the exchange rate, making the local currency, the Bolivar, much weaker, but... All right, this gets kind of confusing because there's the official exchange rate and then the unofficial exchange rate, which apparently most people use. So what will changing the exchange rate, as the president's done, actually do?
So it is a little complicated. One thing that the government is trying to do is hold on to dollars by just not letting people exchange the local currency, bolivars, for any foreign currency. Meanwhile, the local currency is hemorrhaging value. So people really want to get rid of their bolivars. And what they do is they turn to the black currency market, where right now $1 buys 1,000 bolivars. Maduro changed the official rate from $1 buying 6 bolivars to $1 buying 10 bolivars. Mm. You can see there's a huge, huge gap. And that leaves room for all sorts of corruption and arbitrage.
And right now, inflation in Venezuela is nearly 200%. The International Monetary Fund predicts inflation is going to top 700% by the end of the year. I have a hard time getting my head around those numbers. What could 700% inflation look like on the ground in Caracas?
Right now, Venezuela has the world's highest inflation by a lot, but it's not the Weimar Republic. People do walk around with huge satchels of cash. I've gone through 2 wallets in the past couple months just because you walk around with these like balls of cash that destroy the stitching. ATMs haven't kept up at all with inflation, so you can only take out the equivalent of $8 a day.
You say it's not the Weimar Republic, but it sounds pretty dire all the same.
Yeah, you know, I saw a 1 bolivar note sitting on the sidewalk for weeks recently. The currency has just lost so much value that nobody wanted to bother to pick it up. And you see it everywhere. You know, when you're walking around, people always ask, what does something cost today? Even if it's something that they probably buy every day, like a newspaper or bread.
So are people just getting their money and spending it right away?
Exactly. You see people even in the slums buying flat screen televisions, buying refrigerators, because the currency is just bleeding value, and it's going to get so much worse this coming year.
Hannah Dreyer with the Associated Press in Caracas, Venezuela. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. Valentine's Day might have come and gone, but who says love has to be confined to just one day? This week, The World in Words, our podcast about language, explores the intersection of love and language. Here's a little taste from Nina Porzucchi.
This is Verge Randall's story. Verge is a native New Yorker and the daughter of Italian immigrants.
I'll give you a little backstory. My late mother, she and my father were both Sicilian speakers. And because I grew up in a railroad flat, there was not much privacy. So when my parents needed privacy, they would lapse into this dialect. And I knew that it was a special language they had. And years later, after my father died, I was talking to my mother. She had moved into a retirement community, and she was the last of her generation. And she said that the people were very nice, but none of them spoke her dialect, and she was forgetting some of her words. And she said, "I'm losing my Italian."
Virgis thought about her mom's comment in the months and weeks and years since losing her own husband, Michael Randall. He died a few years ago from liver disease. Virgin and Michael didn't speak Italian, but they still had their own dialect, something that Virg has come to call the language of us.
It was the language of couples. It's the language of, I think, really bonding. Any group of people who have a shared experience develop over time, I think, a shorthand. And I really missed the in-jokes that I had with Michael.
And over 30 years of marriage, Virg and Michael had built up quite a vocabulary.
Michael had a 14-year-old sense of humor, which I really enjoyed, but some of them were like punchlines to dirty jokes. That's, you know, and I'm not going to drag you through the whole joke, but one of his favorites was, if we were trying something different to eat, like some different food or something, Michael would say, "If you like it, I'll give you a whole one." Oh, God. You can imagine what the setup to that was.
Each turn of phrase in the language of us has a story. And one of my favorites that Virg shared, do an Uncle Joe.
My Uncle Joe and my Aunt Angie had been married 50 years. And Uncle Joe was a very forthright kind of guy. And everybody had been drinking. And Michael and I went over to say hi to Uncle Joe and Angie. And he took a gulp of his Asti Spumante and looked at his wife and looked at Michael and said, "You got to be willing to lose an argument."
It's good advice.
It sure was. And Michael adopted that. We both did. When an argument would go round and round, sometimes Michael would say, "I'll do an Uncle Joe," and that would be that. I'd say it too, but not as often as Michael.
Will you tell me a little bit about Michael? What kind of guy was he?
Michael was kind of a Renaissance man. He was a wonderful dresser. He was into computers and software programming before it was cool. I don't know. He was just this really, like, funny, cool guy who was really smart and who was okay with, this is going to sound awfully conceited, but he was okay with me being smart, too. He liked that.
When Michael got sick, one phrase became important shorthand.
Just a bump in the road.
You would say that to him, or he would say that to you, or?
I would say that to him. I said it a lot towards the end. I was a very nervous driver. I'm a native New Yorker. I got my license when I was 45.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was quite an experience. I mean, I would sweat my body weight anytime I had to get into the car. But Michael was in no shape to drive, so I would drive. There was a bump in the road that I would have to drive over to take him to the hospital for another meeting with his transplant team. We'd hit this one bump, and I would just go really slowly over it. There was a sign that said, "Calming," and Michael would say, "Calming," you know, just kind of talk me over this little bump, which was really no big deal, and then we'd go on our way.
And so that bump in a road became a metaphorical bump in the road, or part of your lingo?
It became both, yeah, because I was trying to remind him that it was just a minor thing, it wasn't a major thing, we'll just get over it and everything will be fine. And he would remind me to be calm.
Michael died on March 14th, 2009. He was 68 years old.
That was Pi Day and the birthday of Albert Einstein, whom Michael greatly admired. So I thought that it was Michael's fitting and puckish sense of humor that was when he would exit.
After Michael died, Virg still found herself speaking and hearing their language.
I would hear a song lyric because Michael liked to use song lyrics sometimes. The original's still the greatest and, you know, things like that. And I would freeze and I'd be locked in that memory. And I couldn't really move on, and I hit on the idea of writing the lyric and the phrase and the memory and the moment on a piece of paper and putting it in a box that I called the mic box. And then I was able to move forward and continue with what I was doing.
The mic box has gotten quite full over the years. Verge is still collecting words and phrases and song lyrics, though the entries have become fewer as time passes. She hasn't lost her language. It's all there in the box. But still, Verge is keenly aware. Like any language, if you don't use it, you lose it. I asked her to read the last paragraph of her essay. It was the part that I read several times to myself.
Like my mother, I can't remember some of my words. I fear I'm losing my Italian, too. Losing a language for a community smaller than a Sicilian village, a nation of two, now one. But no matter what, I will keep looking and remembering, appreciating each turn of phrase anew, savoring each moment and memory. I can hardly do otherwise. I'm the last speaker of us now.
I'm in with the in crowd.
I love just the idea of the language of love is not I love you or I want to be with you or I need you or anything, but these small everyday phrases that we
right.
say to one another that right. have meaning beyond something else.
That's
that
right.
knit you together.
You could go to a store, you know, and spend $2 on a card that says I love you. But it takes a lifetime to be able to say it's just a bump in the road.
We make every minute count, yeah. Our share is always the biggest of mine.
Verge Randall speaking with the world's Nina Porzucchi. You can hear more stories about love and language on The World in Words. Check it out at pri.org/language. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, one Russian woman's fight to save the stray dogs of Sochi.
She takes dogs off the street. And people in the United States and Canada mostly, but also in Scotland, Poland, and Germany, then adopt them, pay for the price to have them brought over, and then they have a Sochi dog.
That's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Our Across Women's Lives team is in Brazil right now. They're reporting on issues of water, disease, and women's roles in tackling some of Brazil's biggest problems, like Zika. We'll be hearing their stories all next week on the show, so here's a preview, starting with reporter Catherine Osborne. She's reporting on a group of women from Pernambuco State, the epicenter of the Zika crisis in northeast Brazil. These mothers that you've met, Catherine, they've all given birth to babies with microcephaly, abnormally small heads. You visited them in a rehab center. What was going on there?
That's right. The mothers and their children were going through all sorts of rehab. So it was physical therapy, audio rehab, visual rehab. Right now, we know that these babies have unusually small heads, but we don't know what else might develop down the line. So there's a lot of precautionary steps being taken and ways to sort of stimulate the babies as they grow.
Now, I know Pernambuco State is a large state in northeast Brazil. These women and their babies must come from far and wide. Is it a destination for women? Do they know about this clinic?
They're sent to the capital city, Recife, the capital of Pernambuco, because it has the best hospitals and treatment centers. Pernambuco State is where there have been the most cases of confirmed microcephaly since Brazil started counting. And it's far for a lot of women. One person we talked to yesterday had to get up at about 1 in the morning to get there.
Now, despite the distance of this clinic, I gather these women managed to communicate.
Yes, so they both see each other sometimes at events like these therapy sessions, and indeed the therapists have organized the events now so the mothers get more face-to-face time. But in addition to that, the moms, both from Pernambuco State and from Brazil nationally, have created two WhatsApp groups where they swap stories, pictures, information about sort of what they're going through.
And the women you met, Catherine, do they think all of this is helping?
They do. They certainly say that it's a relief to be able to connect with each other. One of the sounds we heard in the clinic yesterday was actually traditional Brazilian instruments. There was a tambourine. There was a rattle made from husks of palm seeds. And one of the audio therapists was playing these musical instruments and saying, you know, just like any child, your baby needs to be stimulated with different sounds. So even though a lot of wonderful therapy is being happened, still a lot more needs to be done.
Well, we're really looking forward to hearing your story and some of these issues, getting deeper into them next week. Reporter Catherine Osborne in Recife. That's also where Katie Wirth is. She's reporting with our Across Women's Lives project and for our partners at Frontline. So you're looking at the bigger picture, Katie, how the universal healthcare system in Brazil is handling not just Zika, but two other major epidemics it was already dealing with before Zika. That'd be dengue and chikungunya, which are both also spread by mosquitoes. So what are you seeing when you visit hospitals and clinics there in Recife?
Just yesterday, we went to a clinic in Ipojuma, which is a small town 45 minutes south of Recife. And we talked to some doctors there and the head nurse, and they told us that they went from seeing about 150 patients a day in their emergency room just a few years ago, and now they're seeing 250 a day.
Wow.
Their medical staff has actually shrunk from 4 doctors to 3 handling all those patients. And they're also running out of some medicines, even basic medicine like Tylenol, to give patients. And we talked to one doctor, Dr. Adriana Scavuzzi, who's the women's health coordinator at the largest maternity hospital in Recife. And here's what she had to say about the prospects of healthcare for these children.
When this outbreak came, we were going to a serious crisis when it comes to health assistance. So it happened in a very bad moment. So I'm sure that there will not be enough support for rehabilitation.
So they're not very optimistic, as you just heard.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So we'll be hearing more on that next week from Brazil. Reporter Katie Wirth in Recife, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Our team in Brazil isn't reporting just on Zika. They're also exploring other water-related issues facing the country. That's why the world's environment reporter Carolyn Beeler traveled to Altamira. That's a city in the Amazon basin in the north of Brazil. She's been reporting on the impact of the massive Belo Monte hydroelectric dam project, which is due to start generating electricity next month. Carolyn, you've been reporting on the impact this dam is having on the local community in and around Altamira. What have you been seeing?
Well, this is a huge infrastructure project, this dam. Its capacity is going to make it the third largest dam in the world. So tens of thousands of acres of forest have been flattened or flooded. There are about 30,000 people that have been displaced from their homes. And a portion of the Xingu River, which I'm actually standing beside right now, has been redirected, which is leading to these big die-offs of fish. And it's changing traditional ways of life for indigenous people and the women that live in those indigenous communities.
Yeah, it sounds still like this project has a potential to really divide the city of Altamira. Is there a lot of tension over this dam? And the women in these communities, are they stepping up to effect some kind of change?
Yeah, they are. Even though this dam is built and it's going to come online next month, there are still a lot of protesters. We talked to one woman named Antonia Mello, who has been protesting this dam since it was first envisioned under the military dictatorship here in the 80s. And she's still keeping the fight alive. She sort of acts as a megaphone for some of the indigenous communities that are really the most impacted, I would say, by this dam. And there are some women leaders there who have been protesting this week the building of the dam by commandeering some buses that take workers to the dam site, blocking the way into the dam to try to slow down work and push for some of the things that have been promised to them as part of this big dam building project.
Yeah, and we'll be hearing your report on that women's camp next week.
Absolutely.
Carolyn Beeler with The World in Altamira, Brazil. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Marco.
You can follow Carolyn and the rest of our Across Women's Lives team in Brazil and see all the impressive women they're meeting. Just follow us on Instagram at Women's Lives and add your thoughts using hashtag HerPlanet. Most people's image of the First World War goes something like this. Men in shell shock, caked in mud, stuck for weeks or months in rain-filled trenches, enduring artillery bombardments and raids from the enemy. But a new study might be challenging some of that. By looking at the diaries kept by soldiers in the British Army, historians have been able to piece together the actual movement of troops at the Western Front. Professor Richard Grayson has been looking at the research. How does this report change our view of First World War combat?
There's a general popular view, fueled by things like television programs, back to the war poets, that men lived in trenches from day to day, from week to week, to month to month. But what the new data shows is that the men were in the front line less than half of their time and under fire or firing at the enemy on only one in five of their days overseas at the war. So this does revise the view that you have, particularly in television programmes like Blackadder Goes Forth, of men living in trenches from one year to the next. There are some isolated examples of soldiers being in trenches for weeks and even months, but that was very, very unusual.
Yeah, Blackadder, Downton Abbey has that whole chapter up on the front. So if the trench experience was not constant, what were the real challenges that soldiers experienced? I assume shell shock and PTSD were very real.
Those were certainly very real. I think we also need to remember that even though the men were not in the front line the majority of the time, the times when they were would still have dominated their war experience. Even when you're behind the lines, knowing that you would have to go to the front again at some point, that you stood a risk of being killed or seriously injured, that would still remain the biggest challenges of the war. However, you also then have to add in that even time in the trenches when not under fire could be exceptionally tedious. And so boredom was quite a factor, which is how you get soldiers publishing satirical newspapers like the Wipers Times just to pass the hours of the day.
So those satirical newsletters, they would kind of trade them among themselves and kind of get a chuckle?
They were circulated around, and yes, they sometimes carried on things that men had been used to doing at home, but they just filled the hours of the day and lightened some fairly bleak moments.
Now, Professor, I know you researched this using unit war diaries. Tell us what those are and what do they tell us that other sources can't?
Every unit of the British Army produced a daily war diary, recording where they were and what they were doing. And they're hugely varied. And throughout the war, apart from a few occasions when pages were lost, these have survived and they tell you day by day, sometimes in battles, even minute by minute, what a particular unit was doing. And these have been put online. They're owned by the National Archives in London. They've been put online in conjunction with the Imperial War Museum and an organization called Zooniverse, who specialize in crowdsourcing. And the thousands of people who have an amateur or some kind of professional interest in the British Army have been looking at those diaries and tagging them, looking at what they were doing. And then we've been able to generate data from the tags that have been applied to the images. And that's what the basis of this research is.
Professor Richard Grayson, updating our understanding of life on the front lines and in the trenches during World War I. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our understanding of World War II is also a work in progress. Some who lived through that time are still alive, like former Nazi guard Reinhold Hanning. He's 94 and on trial right now in Germany. Hanning is accused of aiding in the murder of 170,000 Jews at the Auschwitz concentration camp. I spoke earlier with one of those who testified against him at the trial. He's also 94 years old, an Auschwitz survivor named Leon Schwarzbaum.
I came to Auschwitz 1943. My parents came 4 weeks before I came to Auschwitz. They had been killed right away when the transport came to the chamber, the gas chamber.
And how old were you at the time?
I was at the time about 22 years old.
22, so
yes.
Unlike millions of people, somehow you managed to make it out of the camp and you survived. When did you hear about the trial of this SS guard, Reinhold Hanning. And did you remember him right away when you heard about it?
I don't remember him, but I was at the trial as a witness. And I asked Mr. Hanning, we are at the same age, and we are going to maybe very soon to pass away, you know. I like to ask you to tell the history's truth about this time in Auschwitz. Speak, please, speak here what you and your comrades did in Auschwitz. But because, you know, he didn't want to speak. After this, when I told him to speak, he decided to speak.
And what did he say?
Not yet. He's going to speak. The trial is still going on, you know.
When you said this to Reinhold Hanning in court, though, what was his reaction? Did he look at you?
He looked at me. He looked at me. I looked at him. And I showed the members of the court a photo, you know, of my parents, my dead parents.
Guards like this SS member, Reinhold Hanning, what kinds of things typically did they do as guards in Auschwitz?
They guard the people when they worked, or they guard on the tower.
Now, there was this moment many times in the camp, these things called the selections, those dire episodes where prisoners were picked to die in the gas chambers. Were guards involved in those things called the selections?
Of course. Selections was a dangerous time, you know, because you should take over your clothes, and they showed at you, are you in good condition or are you not in good condition? If you are not in good condition, right away to the chimney, you know.
Leon Schwarzbaum, what do you hope happens with this trial?
He must be sentenced because he helped the whole machinery of killing, but he's an old man. He should tell the truth, what happened there. This is very important for young people. I am going to the schools and I am telling what happened in Auschwitz. I am always going to schools, telling them.
If Reinhold Hanning is sentenced, will you feel any better about the family that you lost?
Yes, I think so. If he is going to be sentenced, but more important is that he has to tell the truth. What happened? How is everything happened there? It was a terrible time for us to be in Oświęcim, Auschwitz.
Leon Schwarzbaum, I greatly appreciate your time speaking with us today. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much.
94-year-old Auschwitz survivor Leon Schwarzbaum, he testified earlier this month at the trial of a former Nazi concentration camp guard. I get an education on the violin in Iranian musical scales from a top musician in Tehran. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Remember the Sochi Olympics? It's probably a blur of gold and silver medals, ski jumps, and double axels by now. Not to mention the blur at the end of the games as Russia and Ukraine went into an ugly standoff that led to the annexation of Crimea. But back to those Olympic games. 2 years ago, the southern Russian resort city of Sochi hosted them. And one thing the Russians had to do to get ready for them was a last-minute effort to rid the streets of Sochi of stray dogs. Boston Globe reporter David Filipov is with me. David, pick up the story from there. Were stray dogs in Sochi actually shot and killed?
Yeah, well, they were shooting them and killing them. Somebody had a picture of dogs being, administered a lethal injection. And you could definitely see that there were a lot of dogs in the city.
Right, hard to miss them. So how did you meet Vlada Provotorova?
Somebody had told me that there's this woman who drives around named Vlada Provotorova who was picking up dogs at the station and other places where they, you know, be in big packs, picking up dogs off the street. And I said, let me go around with her. So she's like, no, I'm not going anywhere today. I'm just going to my shelter. And I'm like, I don't want to go to no shelter. But I went along anyway. And there I saw this sort of makeshift shelter where she was keeping dogs. And she told me about what she was doing, you know, she was actually trying to save these dogs that were otherwise going to get killed.
Not just save them, but apparently she turned into kind of a broker for people who wanted to adopt them as well.
Well, people read my story. And two women who emigrated from Russia also read it. They got in touch with Vlada and they decided to set up a nonprofit. And that's what they did. It's called Sochi Dogs. And through that, they started arranging for adoptions to people in the United States who wanted a dog.
Basically petfinder.com, but just for dogs from Sochi.
Just for dogs from Sochi. And the thing is that, you know, people have asked me, aren't there other places where there are dogs? And doesn't the United States have homeless dogs? And it's true. I mean, when you decide to do something to save somebody, you know, you have a lot of choices. The thing about Sochi dogs is that they are strays because dog owners in Russia very often don't get their dogs neutered or spayed. Dog comes home, has puppies that nobody wants or can afford. The puppies, you know, get discarded. And then they become strays. In Sochi, puppies that are discarded can become strays because it's subtropical climate. Homeless dogs can survive. In other places in Russia, that wouldn't happen. You know, Yakutia, where the winter temperature is minus 50. The thing is, it's because they're brought into this world in this kind of careless way.
So how's her work going 2 years after the Olympics? Is she still kind of a dog activist?
Yeah, she always has 50 dogs in the shelter. She gets them vaccinated, spayed or neutered. She's had 91 adopted. She's had, you know, 137 or so that have been spayed or neutered. So it's not like she's got thousands and thousands of dogs, but it's become a thing and it's ongoing. Now, the strays of Sochi number in the hundreds, if not thousands.
Wow.
So it's just a little effort. But the thing that's remarkable to me about it is that she started it and she's kept it going, and that there are so many Sochi dog owners all over the world.
How many Sochi dog owners are there in the United States?
It's 52 in the United States, 36 in Canada. One of the ones in the United States is Kelly Stack, who was the forward on the women's hockey team that won silver medal. You know, she's really psyched about her Sochi dog. You know, they're dogs. They're dogs in a lot of other places.
Any specific breed or just?
It's a German Shepherd mix, German Shepherd, Yellow Lab, and also Chihuahua, which, again, gives you some of the idea of what happens when you're a dog on the street. Yeah. It was called Scheibe, which means hockey puck in the United States.
What about you? Did you step into that shelter and say, no, I'm not going to adopt? And then did one kind of grab you by the heart?
You've got 50 of them looking at you and just try not to get a dog. Luckily for me, I have a cat and that would have been a problem.
Yeah.
So I didn't. That's what stopped me.
Boston Globe reporter David Filipov, thanks very much for telling us about this dog project. It's really cool.
Thanks for having me.
1 week ago, I was in Tehran thinking about music. Here, let me take you back to last Friday and another one of our Tehran stories.
So I've come to the Vakhdat Concert Hall here in downtown Tehran tonight. Friday night, everybody's out enjoying the evening. And there's an ensemble called the Vazari Ensemble that will be performing tonight classical Iranian music. And I've come down to get one of their chief violinists, Arash Jameh, to instruct me, if that is possible, in this very complex system of Iranian scales. What does that exactly mean?
Now, just so you know, I've been playing violin since the age of 6. I learned Western scales, like most kids here. But with Iranian classical music, between a natural note and a sharp note, for example, there's another note, a microtone, that does not exist in music here, so it doesn't exist in my brain. I asked Arash Jameh to explain some of this to me on paper.
So there's a flat, but between a natural and a flat in Iranian is a koron. And then between natural and sharp, it's called sori.
Sori.
Very graciously, Arash and his fellow violinist Mansour Safayan escorted me to their green room backstage to demonstrate some of the finer points of microtones and the Iranian scale.
F natural, F sharp, F sori.
So Arash has handed me his violin. This is... So that's the whole stub.
Yes.
That's the that's the F.
Sorry.
That's a, oh, I did the sorry. That wasn't just a flat.
It was really hard and humbling trying to discern and make a note that doesn't occur naturally to me.
He says, this sound produced might a bit to you is a bit weird, but to an Iranian who is used to this sound, it doesn't sound that weird, okay? They are familiar to it.
We know it's a consonant, but maybe you dissonant.
But there are some dissonant notes, like in the blues scale, like a minor blues. Like.
Yeah, that may be true, but even a minor blues scale sounds upbeat compared to Iranian microtones.
So, you know, my violin teacher always gave me work to do, a lesson. So when I go back to the United States, what should I practice so I get this?
He says, you've not been exposed to it. You are not very familiar to this kind of sound. So it's much more difficult for you.
Yeah, Mansour, it sounds like you're telling me, do not try this at home.
I don't want to discourage you. What I suggest you to do is to improve your listening. I mean, you need to listen to it first and to get familiar to this kind of music and then start playing it.
I've been kind of busy since I got home last week and haven't been the most conscientious student. I know, excuses. Lucky for me, though, that Arash Jameh gave me a list of 5 Iranian composers I need to pay attention to and get my ear attuned to that sonic universe. We've got that list at PRI.org. Okay, enough of the amateur hour. Let's hear a little of the Viziri Ensemble now. Here's some of their sound check from last Friday. Yeah, listen, practice. And that's it for us this week. Eric Goldberg composed our theme music from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.